Welcome to Running Start, the podcast that's been made to run to. Brought to you by VHI, sponsors of the VHI Women's Mini Marathon. 5 episodes of increasing length, designed to help you gradually work up to 10K on the big day, or any routes after that. In episode 5, for your 75-minute session, you'll hear Eimear McLysett and Sarah Breen.
I'm Eimear McLysett.
And I'm Sarah Breen, and we're creators of the Aisling book series.
Sarah and I met in Ballyfermot College of Further Education in the early 2000s.
Yeah, it feels like a long time ago now.
But it feels like yesterday, Sarah.
It was both of our kind of second run at college. I had gone to DCU to study languages initially.
And I'd gone to Trinity to study science. And it was a false start for both of us.
And then, lo, we ended up in Ballyfermot College of Further Education studying media.
Yeah, we were doing kind of a media, radio, television, journalism course. And I can still remember the first day I met Sarah. And she was wearing a denim skirt and UGG boots. And she was one of the first people I'd ever seen that made UGG boots look really, really cool.
Can I just say that UGG boots had just come out at that stage? I was an early adopter.
Well, I was blown away by her style.
And we got talking, and we're both from the countryside. We had a very similar sense of humour. We were both very into socialising at the time, and especially going to see like live music. So we spent a lot of our first year in the evenings going to Whelan's, big gang of us. And then in the second year, me and Eimear had hit it off so well, and our friend groups had kind of merged. We decided to move in together.
Yeah, we lived in an apartment we affectionately called Brilliant Street, and we called it that so often that people sometimes thought that we lived on actual Brilliant Street.
Yeah, one of our college friends tried to get a taxi to bring her to Brilliant Street one day. It did not go well. And it was in Brilliant Street that we kind of conceived.
Yeah, that's where we started coming up with the idea of Aisling. So Aisling has been with us as a character for a long time now, like 15 years, maybe over 15 years.
Yeah, it's long before the books came out. We were talking about her and kind of assigning traits and characteristics to her. So she's a long time in the making.
She really is.
If I recall correctly, I think we started talking about Aisling in a conversation about brown mascara.
Yeah, I think we were trying to think, you obviously see brown mascara when you're in a pharmacy or you're, you know, buying your bits. And we were like, who are the people who buy brown mascara? Because generally your eyelashes are brown or close enough to it.
And at that time, we couldn't be wearing enough eyeliner and mascara, black mascara at the time. Yeah. So we were like, who's keeping the brown mascara industry going?
And we just started building this persona of who we eventually called Aisling. And she was the girl who bought the brown mascara because black just seemed like a bit too much of a commitment.
And she probably read one time in a magazine that brown mascara makes blue eyes pop.
Yeah.
And she will take that information to her grave.
And then we kind of started with other traits like that. And it was like, Aisling has never dyed her hair because, you know, it is a little bit mousy, but it goes a lovely golden colour in the sun.
And this was around the time where Jennifer Aniston and Brad Pitt had broken up. And we were like, Aisling is 100% Team Jen.
Yeah, that was one of her very strong Aisling traits.
And around that time as well, the plastic bag levy had been brought in. And me and Eimear would be struggling back to Brilliant Street with our groceries hanging out of our pockets and our arms. We'd be like, Aisling would never forget to bring a bag for life. She would always have one with her.
So a lot of her early characteristics were kind of around how sensible she was, how kind she was as well. She would always help someone out. And then funny things like, you know, she would always buy brown mascara. Like at a wedding, Aisling would never take her heels off before the bride. That is just bad manners.
She's a stickler for rules. And she would never do things like that we used to do, like, you know, hoover up coppers rather than just like picking them up. Sensible, kind. And it just became a topic of conversation amongst our friends. You know, we'd be like, Aisling can believe it's not butter, you know, all these types of things. And then one day Eimear decided to make a Facebook group.
Yeah, so the Facebook group came about because this was in the time, we're really dating ourselves here, but this was in the time before really group messaging, WhatsApp, Facebook groups, you know, messaging groups even. And we wanted a way to kind of bring together all of the Aislingisms, all of the little jokes, all of the little bits, so that we could share them with our friends.
And at this stage, it was us and a very small group of our friends who kind of got the idea, the concept of Aisling immediately.
And we would get texts from somebody going, oh, I'm on my holidays and I just saw an Aisling. She's roasting. It's 22 degrees.
Yeah, I'm in Spain. I can see somebody wearing a Mayo jersey. It's Aisling. And yeah, so Eimear created the Facebook group and we joined and our friends joined. And then slowly, very, very slowly, you know, new people would join, but we would always be able to trace them back, you know, to that, that's Anya's cousin or that's Brita's sister.
Yeah, or they were friends of friends or, you know, but everyone seemed to get it and everyone would be posting on the Facebook group going, you know, Aisling does this and Aisling would never do that and Aisling can't wait for, you know, XYZ.
And then one time, Emer, you were in a pub in town.
I was in a pub in town and it was early evening and I was waiting for maybe you, Sarah.
Possibly.
And I heard a conversation beside me and somebody referred to somebody else in the conversation as a complete Aisling. And those two people were complete strangers to me. I didn't know who they were. And I was like, oh my God.
Are it's grown legs.
They're talking about our Aisling.
Yeah.
And I was like, she sounds lovely. That Aisling sounds lovely.
It was crazy. And then there was a piece on a TV show about, it was a TV show, Ray D'Arcy Presents, and it was about wedding dresses. And I was watching Gogglebox Ireland, and one of the guys on Gogglebox said, oh, all the Aislings at home are going mad for this segment. And I couldn't believe that.
We were like, we've created a character, an Aisling.
A figment of our imagination was mentioned on national television. So that's how we knew that it had kind of grown legs and, you know, there could be something big for us down the line. Not that we would ever work specifically towards anything. We were doing nothing about it at this stage, yeah, by our posting in the Facebook group.
We never thought that it would come to where it is now, which is, you know, books, and we make a living basically out of writing with Aisling. And yeah, it's great. Deal came about kind of, we feel kind of lucky because it kind of came to us. I mean, we had put in a lot of work on the Facebook group and creating the character, but it was kind of for us and our friends and for people to enjoy more than anything else.
Yeah, we didn't realise that we were building this universe and this character and this whole world. We were just doing it for fun.
Yeah, and Sarah and I were both working in journalism, writing at the time. We both have a background in journalism and writing. And Gill Books approached us and said, look, we know this character has a big appeal. People seem to really like her. Would you be interested in putting something on paper, having something published? We think, you know, it could reach a wide audience. At the time, we think they were thinking about something more kind of like a gift book, kind of, you know, a collection of Aisling-isms, or, you know you're an Aisling if, that kind of thing.
Yeah, because Gill don't publish fiction traditionally. And as Emer said, both our backgrounds are in writing. And, you know, when you work in journalism, writing a book is one of those things where you're like, someday, you know, when I'm out to pasture, I'll sit down and do it. And then when we were approached by Gill, it was like, okay, this thing has been handed to us. How are we going to, you know, we want to do it. Me and Emer had wanted to work together for a long time in some kind of professional capacity. And we decided that if we were going to do something with our beloved Aisling, we didn't want it to be something that is going to wind up in Oxfam on January 2nd. We wanted to kind of bring Aisling to as wide an audience as we could, like outside Facebook, like maybe try and get our mothers to understand the concept. So we went back to them and said, how about if we do a novel?
Yeah, and I mean, we were kind of putting the cart before the horse because all we had thought about is maybe we could do a novel. We hadn't thought about what it might be about or
how do you write a novel
or how long it might take us. And Gill, God bless them, came back and said, okay, well, we're open to that idea. Write us a kind of synopsis of what it would be about and come back to us, say, you know, Tuesday week. So we said, right.
So on Monday evening of that week, we met in a pub in town with Emer's old laptop and we were like, okay, what, we put together a storyline for a novel. How does this, we're literally sitting in the pub Googling what happens in novels.
How do you write a book? Novel?
And we were like, okay, we have our Aisling. We need to throw some challenges at her. And one of the cornerstones of Aisling's personality is that she's living this life of quiet desperation, just waiting for her boyfriend, her long-suffering boyfriend, to pop the question. So we're like, okay, how about we start with she's waiting, he doesn't do it, and then she just snaps and goes, fine, we're breaking up, and then we'll see where we can bring her.
And it was really important to us to empower Aisling as well, to not, I mean, describing her there, she sounds a little bit like, oh, just waiting to be engaged and waiting for the, you know, and we wanted to make sure that she was living the fullest life possible, and we wanted to give the supporting characters like her mother, her dad, you know, all those people kind of a rounder life than the stereotypes that are usually put on those kinds of people. So it gave us a chance to do that.
And at the time, you know, in our 20s, we had had such crack living together in Brilliant Street. We wanted Aisling to have that life as well. And we really wanted to make sure that we illustrated that friendships are as important as romantic relationships in your life. So we were like, okay, we have to introduce Aisling to people that she mightn't necessarily know from down home and, you know, see how she faces these challenges.
Yeah, and I think Aisling's kind of widening group of particularly female friends has become a real backbone to the books as they've gone on. Like, it's always been very important that she's, you know, made great friends, maintained great friends, that she's shown kindness to her friends and that they've done the same back.
One of the things, you know, in books and TV and films as well, sometimes if you have a group of friends together, a group of women together, there's a lot of backbiting and catfighting and stuff, and that's just kind of not really our experiences with friends. You know, that's not what good friends are for, so we wanted to give Aisling that experience as well. And that synopsis that we wrote in the pub that day, we didn't really deviate much from it. That has become the storyline of Oh My God, What a Complete Aisling, which is our first novel in the series.
By the time we wrote the book, the Facebook group was quite large.
Yeah, I think we had about 30,000 members.
Yeah. But we were really, really conscious. So obviously the Facebook group had been going for several years at that point by the time it was, you know, we're going to write this book about Aisling. But we were really conscious that some of the Aisling content that we had created was ours and some of it was from the minds of other people. And that was what other people had dreamed up about Aisling. And people had different versions of Aisling in their head. Like, for some, it was a much more conservative girl. For some, it was a girl from their own personal hometown, and we were really conscious that we didn't want to take anyone else's ideas. So probably the kind of essence of Aisling did come from the Facebook group.
There's some shared experience, but there's characters that were created in the Facebook group that don't appear in the books because they're not characters we created. You know, we created Aisling's immediate family, Mammy, Daddy, Magella. And they had been mentioned in the Facebook group. But then we have a whole, you know, all the people that she meets in Dublin, they were never mentioned on Facebook. And I think, who was it? Is it Rodrigo or somebody? There's somebody in the group. Everyone was like, why isn't he in the book?
Well,
he didn't come from our heads. We don't know anything about him, really, apart from he's pretty funny on the Facebook page. But that's not our content.
And I mean, obviously, it would have been lovely to have that kind of beloved character in the book, but that's not our character to take, so we didn't do that. What we did do was we ran a competition on the Facebook group and we asked people to come up with a brand new character, and the prize was that this character would be featured in the novel, just like a little.
So there's no storyline around it. It's a very tiny mention, and we had so many fantastic entries.
Funny. So the winning entry was a lovely girl called Emily, and she wrote a character called Geraldine who owned the boutique in BGB, Ballygobackwards, Ballygobard, which is where Aisling is from. And she sold every teenage girl their first sports bra.
The sloggy bras.
Yeah.
And the pretty poly tights. She would measure everyone for the first bra. And she's kind of permatanned and leathery skinned.
Yeah.
And she thinks she's very glamorous. But when we read about this Geraldine, we were like, okay.
It has to be Geraldine.
So Geraldine exists now in the Aisling universe in the background.
Yeah. But the Facebook group was and has been so supportive. Like, they've been so excited about the books coming out, and Aisling tends to be a really popular Christmas present, and then every Christmas we get, you know, messages from people going, I got my Aisling, I can't wait to read it. So it has been a lovely community.
Thank you.
You've been going for 15 minutes. Let's up the pace.
When we first started writing Aisling, one of the things that was important to us was to reflect what it was like to be a woman in Ireland at the time, which I think was 2017, and what it was like to be a woman with her friends, and what were they talking about. And what, so I think that really informed what we wrote the first book and subsequent books about. So the concept of Aisling being surrounded by a group of women is really important to us, and we've built up this really strong network of, well, she has had friends, like Magella and her have been friends since childhood. She has this cast of characters, you know, a few Sineads, a Maeve, you know, Denise, who are always there in BGB, and then she has her new friends that she meets in the various, you know, situations she finds herself in. And that's hugely important. I think the friendship in the books is probably one of the most important themes, I'd say.
Yeah, and I guess maybe traditionally Aisling would have liked to have gone from living at home with her parents to maybe moving in with a boyfriend and eventually, you know, building a house together and, you know, settling down and having that life. And because Emer and I and all of our friends have lived together over the years, you know, in our early 20s, we didn't want Aisling to be robbed of that experience. And, you know, when you move in with people, you really, it's like when you go on holidays with a friend for the first time, you know, you really forge that bond. And yeah, even in our fourth book, which we've just finished, Aisling is still absolutely relying on her friends for everything, as they rely on her too as well. I mean, Aisling is, there's no better friend in a friend group than an Aisling. And in our new book, she is again kind of navigating new waters and meeting new people, and an urban family is very, very important to her.
When it came to writing the book, neither of us had ever written a book. So
we hadn't a clue what we were doing.
And definitely there isn't much information out there about how to write a book together. I mean, a lot of academic books and things like that are written together, but novels don't tend to be written by two people. So we kind of created our own blueprint for how to write the book. We left it for as long as we could until we were like, okay, the deadline is really starting to loom.
This is a classic technique for us. We still do this. If you put things on the long finger, you don't have time to worry about them too much. You just have to get doing it.
Serial procrastinators will know what we mean.
Yes. And we had limited time to do it as well, because we were doing it in the evenings, because we were both working full time at the time. So we opened a Google Doc, which you can work on simultaneously. We flipped a coin to see who would have to start first.
To see whoever lost had to write the first chapter.
And I remember I lost /won, I don't know. And I was like, okay, I'm just going to give it a go. I'll put a first chapter down. And at this stage, we're like, do you write it in first person, third person? How do you do it? So we decided we're going to do it everything from Aisling's point of view, inside Aisling's head. So I did the first chapter, which, you know, has been edited to the nth degree at this stage. It's not what appears in the book. But I remember texting Emer going, you know what, this book, it's actually not that bad. It's actually quite enjoyable.
And anyone who's read the first Aisling book will know that that first chapter is the iconic "we're going to miss the hotel breakfast" scene, where Aisling and John sleep in after being at a wedding, and they wake up going, "we're going to miss the hotel breakfast." Another cornerstone of Aisling's personality is that she would never miss a hotel breakfast. It's included in the price. You get up no matter what.
Yes, and we had talked long and hard about, like, how can we introduce readers to this concept so clearly from the very get-go? And still to this day, people come up to us at literary festivals and, like, on the street and stuff and go, I would not miss a hotel breakfast either. Because there seems to be two cohorts of people. They're the people who are up getting their breakfast regardless of how hungover they are. And then there's people who are like, sure, we'll just sleep in. The same people, this haunts me, the same people stay in bed until housekeeping are knocking on their door.
Aisling would never do that.
Never
she
do
is
it. The shame.
Up and packed and out the door at 11:45.
Yes. But the way it should be.
So Sarah wrote the first chapter, I wrote the second chapter, and we kind of continued like that. We had asked, or Googled maybe, how long is a book? You know, how long is a piece of string?
How long is a chapter?
And, you know, commercial fiction, you know, kind of 80,000 is kind of, you know, anything less than that would be.
I think there was a figure kind of on our contract, but, like, you have to reach this word count or
else. Maybe that was it. So that was
our motivation.
That was what was in our heads. We were like, right, there's the finish line. We have to get to it. And we just started writing. We wrote chapters at the same time as each other, but we knew what was going to happen in those chapters. Then we would email them to each other, read them, come together and go, right, what happens now with Aisling and John and whoever else she was meeting? And it kind of just went on like that.
When we explained this technique to other writers, they are absolutely horrified. They're like, how do you understand what the other person's thinking, or what your characters are thinking? But we know Aisling so well. At this stage, we've been talking about Aisling for like 10 or 11 years. So there's nothing that can be going on that we wouldn't know how she would react to. So it just, it worked for us, and we're still doing it that way. Nothing has changed. We're still using Google Docs. I know you can get all sorts of fancy software, but we are rejecting.
You don't need it. You don't need it. Google Docs is free. Oh, there have been so many memorable and enjoyable moments from writing, you know, the first book and all the books together.
Although my main memories of writing the first book are just sitting in our playroom, or my playroom, with a kind of a scattered diagram of like characters' names and arrows and stuff going, how have we written ourselves into a corner? How can we get out of it? So it is, it's not all, you know, typing and looking wistfully out the window, smiling. It's
in a writing nook.
Yeah.
Neither of us had a writing nook.
As if. It can be like putting a puzzle together, because you have to try and get all these pieces to match up, and you know, you want the reader to be satisfied, you need resolution. But we also have great crack drinking wine and editing, and eating jellies and editing.
we've had so many amazing experiences that have come from writing the books and the books being a success. We've got to travel a lot together. We've got to travel particularly all over Ireland. We've got to decide what happens with this character. We've got to kind of, like, we love her and know her so much, but we've got to decide, right, what is going to happen to her in this, say, the second book. We had to, you know, we weren't expecting to ever write a second book.
Oh God, not in a million
years.
We
thought nobody would read the first book, and that, like, that's not false modesty. We genuinely thought maybe our moms, maybe our friends, maybe 10 other people, that would be it.
We were counting up our friends and family between us going, okay, well, you know, there's two of us, so that's a few more sales. And then Emer had made the fatal mistake of asking Gil, what happens to books that aren't sold? And they said that books get pulped.
They send them back and they get pulped. I was like,
for weeks all we did was talk about all the books that were going to be pulped on our watch.
But we're focusing on the positive aspects of writing books together. Yeah. And we just, like, we're great friends. We were friends before Aisling ever came along, and it has really, I've made quite a unique friendship, I think, because we are kind of, you know, business partners, colleagues, but we're also still really good friends. And as I said, we travel a lot together. We go to a lot of scary events together. Like, we've had to do a lot of scary stuff, getting up in front of a lot of people. And it's so much easier when you've got your friend beside you and you don't have to do it on your own. We often say, like, we can't, authors who travel on their own and do these events and everything on their own, we can't imagine how they do it.
Because it's such a hermit-like existence, you know, it's just you late at night with your laptop, and then suddenly, if your book takes off, you're expected to stand up in front of a group of 200 people and know what to say, and that can be really difficult. I think my favourite moment was when the first book came out, and because our expectations were so low when it started, it went into the charts straight away, like somewhere 7 or 8 or yeah, something, and it stayed there for so long, and then it started to climb, and then it just became such a success, and then we were getting these emails, and we got an agent, and we got a UK book deal, and it all started to really spiral and take off, and it was like, you know, this is going to amazing places that we just never in a million years imagined. Somewhat unexpected bonus of writing a book that has done well is that you get invited to literary festivals,
yeah,
all around the country, sorry. And I had never gone to a literary festival before I was invited to speak at one. Had you ever?
No, I remember we were invited to our very first literary festival. I think it was in...
It was in Limerick. Oh my God, I remember that one.
Yes.
And for some reason, that when you go onto the website of the venue, you were able to see how many tickets had been sold. I've never encountered this before, but I was crippled with anxiety about the lack of tickets that had been sold.
Sorry, I don't have texting me going, there's only 50 people. There's only 57 people.
They've only sold 4 tickets.
But we were so excited, and that was a great event. People did come, and they did invite us, and they did come up afterwards.
A lot of people, can I just say, a lot of people buy tickets on the day or on the evening of.
So if you're ever worried that somebody's not going to come to your event, they'll probably show up on the day.
They
don't
buy them on the door.
But that turned into kind of a couple of years, really, of travelling to literary festivals.
It's a bit like being on tour.
We kind of have done a tour of Ireland. We've spent a lot of time in the West, in the Southwest.
We spent a lot of time in the car.
We spent a lot of time in the car. Luckily, we can both drive, and we both enjoy a sucky sweet. So we usually stop at one of our favourite petrol stations to get a sucky sweet, and then we travel on. Like, we've spent some gorgeous time in Cork, West Cork.
I think one of my favourite ones, which is probably the kind of most respected, I guess, or maybe the longest running literary festival is the one in Listowel.
Oh yeah, the Listowel Literary Festival. When we were asked to do that, we were so pleased. Like, we couldn't believe, and we were kind of one of the, not the headline, but like we were one of
We were a Saturday night.
We were kind of high enough up on the poster. And we had an amazing time. We did our event. It went down really well. People loved it. And then the Listowel, like the Listowel Literary Festival is very kind of commute, like a lot of people, like everyone kind of moves around the town together and, oh, we're going to this pub.
And it's very inclusive. I mean, the whole town is involved in this. So you go to a pub and it looks like just a normal venue from outside, but inside somebody could be doing poetry, somebody else could be, you know, performing a little bit from a play. And these aren't necessarily people who are at the literary festival, they're just local people.
Yeah, so after our event at the Listowel Literary Fest, we went
Let's just say we stayed out late.
We stayed out late. We went to one of the pubs. There was a couple of other people from the festival there. There was a sing-song going on out the back. We were out the back with, I don't know if anyone knows of the writer Anthony Horowitz. He's like quite big in the publishing world. So it was me, Anthony and Sarah singing Oasis songs in the corner of the back of this pub. And we got home late, and the next morning
We went to Jumbo's,
which is
the amazing chipper in Listowel.
A Listowel institution. We went to Jumbo's for a bit of late night dinner. Got home, woke up the next morning and said, you know what?
We have to get out of here.
It'd be nice to leave Listowel with that as their memory of us, rather than these kind of very tired looking women kind of dragging themselves out of the hotel. So we said, right, listen, we'll hop in the car, we'll say farewell to Listowel, and that'll be that. And literally everyone we had met the night before saw us on the street as we tried to leave Listowel. There's the girls. Oh, there's the girls.
Somehow they were all up that early in the morning.
The man who owns Jumbo's,
he was there.
Beep, beep, there's the girls. Great night, girls. Anthony Horowitz probably hanging out a window going, see you again, girls.
See you around. Yeah.
And it just is such a lovely memory and such a warm memory. And it really is one of the perks of this whole book writing is that kind of, that you get to travel, you get to meet people, you get to do things that you would really never have done if we hadn't written a book together.
And we're so looking forward to things opening back up and the day that we get to get back in the car, go to Barack Obama Plaza, buy ourselves a keyring and some sucky sweets,
and
go to another festival.
Yeah. Another one of our book festival journeys was down to Burris in County Carlow, which is actually the town Sarah is from.
It's my hometown. My entire family were there. But we have like a quite a fancy literary festival there at the moment. It's not even a literary festival. It incorporates everything. It's called the Burris House Festival of Writing and Ideas. So we were super chuffed to be on the bill for that because they had actual celebrities there. I'm talking Cillian Murphy.
Cillian Murphy was there. He was...
Bob Geldof was there.
Bob Geldof was there. When you're an artist performing at this Burris Festival, all the artists eat their meals together. So you get a ticket, you go into this tent.
They call it supper because it's fancy.
Oh, it's a supper, yeah, very fancy. They have this gorgeous buffet. I think Doreen Allen was there making something at one point. It was extremely fancy. And we were just in the queue for our dinner with Bob Geldof.
Eyes on stalks, trying to act like we didn't even care that Bob Geldof was there.
I think he asked me at one point, was the couscous nice? And I was like, yeah, it's grand. Yeah, it's lovely, very nice. I would recommend it. And Cillian Murphy was there wearing an enormous scarf.
We talked about his scarf for a good while. It was like a blanket.
Yeah, he is a lot smaller than you'd think, but a very beautiful man.
Very handsome in person.
So, they're probably some of the biggest celebrities, I would say, we've come across. We've come, in, been very close to.
And acting very nonchalant, of course.
My favourite early moments in the whole book writing process was when Marion Keyes got in touch to tell us that she had read and enjoyed the book. We are long-time Marion Keyes fans. When Sarah and I lived together, we used to share her books all the time. We used to share a room when we were in college, and we used to share her books back and forth. Such amazing fans, and she was such an inspiration. And then she used to make a video diary about books she was enjoying, and lo and behold, in her video diary, she was holding a copy of Oh My God, What a Complete
Ashley. I actually have a screenshot of that in my family album.
Yeah.
It was a huge moment for us, and when that vlog came out, I rang Emer, and I never ring anyone because it's just very aggressive thing to do. I would just text. list. And I was screaming down the phone, Marion's read the book, Marion's read the book. And she gave it such a generous review. She was so kind about it. And she had a book herself out that month. And she still just didn't think twice about like saying the loveliest thing and just urging people to go out and buy our book. And then it really took off.
Yeah, it was amazing. We were absolutely blown away by the reception to our first book. Like, we genuinely didn't think that it was going to reach any kind of audience. We had the Facebook group and that had a certain number of people who we knew would be aware of the book, but we just didn't think it would kind of grab people's imaginations the way it did.
And we weren't sure if everybody would get the concept of Aisling and get that, you know, we hold her so close to our hearts. And when, in the first couple of days when the book hit the bookshops, you know, the booksellers were giving feedback to our publisher and they're like, you know, it's going really well, a lot of people are buying it. And we were like, oh yeah, but you know, that's just our friend such and such and our friend such and such. And then at the end of the second week, we had heard that it went into the bestseller chart, somewhere around 7 or 8, I think. And that was hugely exciting for us. I mean, it was out of the realms of possibility, I think, when we were writing the book. And then it stayed in the bestseller chart and stayed and stayed. And then it started to climb. And then it eventually got up to number one. And I believe we were Christmas number one.
I remember David Walliams had a book out. Was it David Walliams had a book out at the same time? And he would have been kind of pegged to be definitely the Christmas number one. And then I think it was like something out of Love Actually. It was like the figures were coming in on Christmas Eve, and it was like, will we be Christmas number
one? Put us on top of the pops quickly.
And we were Christmas number one, and it was really, really amazing. And that was when people first started sending us pictures of the book that they'd gotten as a Christmas present.
People in Australia, Saudi Arabia were waking up and like posting pictures of them reading their book. People were finding the book in hostels in like Bali and places like that. I mean, it just never in a million years, you know, the book was only sold in Ireland, but still it started to travel. Then we got ourselves a literary agent, which just sounds very fancy.
Extremely fancy.
And it kind of is.
We had this really serendipitous meeting with Donal Ryan, who's a writer that we both really like loved and still love, and he writes such amazing work. And we had met him just by chance in town one evening, and he insisted on buying us a drink, and then he sat us down. He said, this is my email address, if you ever need anything get in touch. And he said, my other piece of advice, get an agent, you need an agent. We had done the first book without one, and he was kind of, I think, incredulous, going, oh, you did this without an agent, that's impressive. So then we did end up getting an agent with some help from
our good friend Marion Keyes.
And we're still with that agent, Sheila. She's great, and it has been invaluable having that kind of support and someone who knows what they're at.
And then of course, once the book had taken off, we had a meeting and our publisher suggested, hey, would you guys be interested in doing a second book? Now, we didn't think this was going to happen at all, and in fact we killed off a beloved character in the first book, which we wouldn't have done.
We often say if we knew we were going to write more than one book, we might have, you know, not tied up so many loose ends
And then they were like, yeah, just do a book forever, every year forever. But we decided that we would cap it at 5 books.
Yeah, I think we initially agreed to write books 2 and 3, not thinking like the steam will run out of this, like it won't, you know, it won't keep going. We can't keep going on this success. But we were wrong.
Yeah, then the second book came out and my God, the reaction, there was no chat about books getting pulped at that stage. The reaction was amazing. And the same with the third book. Thank you. once our first book came out and was successful, we were offered a deal to do two more books. And I think that I found that very challenging, because suddenly there was this weight of expectation, and we already had readers coming up to us and sending us messages saying that they loved Aisling and they can't wait for this to happen and that to happen. And when you realise that you have built this community and they're counting on the next book to be really good and really enjoyable, I just have kind of issues with, you know, not living up to expectations and stuff. So I found that really hard.
I found it really hard as well. And I would get messages from people saying, oh, this has to happen for Aisling, and I want this to happen for Aisling. And I was so impressionable. I was like, oh, I don't want to let that specific reader down, so I'm going to have to put that into the book. I think we did kind of come around to the idea that we weren't going to please everyone all of the time. And we genuinely have written each book going, this is the one they're not going to like. This is the one that's going to, they'll be like, no, these two, kick them to the curb. And that hasn't happened, which has been amazing. But I mean, there's a lot of challenges. There's been a lot of kind of juggling, you know, with two people, you obviously have to like juggle schedules and stuff. But I think we have made it work really, really well. We get asked a lot, what do you fight about? Tell us about your biggest fight. We genuinely, and this sounds really cheesy, but we genuinely have never had a fight.
No.
Over, I think as friends, but also over Aisling.
No, life is too short for all that. And as we said earlier, we tend to procrastinate quite a bit. So we just don't have enough time for all that.
We've no time for rows.
And as much as we work together and we've built Aisling together, we also can get together for dinners, lunches, we go on holidays together and never mention work, never mention a book, never mention anything.
Yeah.
And it's so nice to be able to switch off and just we maintain our normal friendship.
Yeah. So we go on holidays quite a lot with a group of friends, and I think they kind of know not to ask us about work. Like, we would never talk about, you know,
I wouldn't expect them to talk about work either,
so
you know.
We're able to put it behind us.
And from the get-go, we've said that our friendship is more important than anything. And if either of us wanted to stop at any point or you know, take a break or whatever it is, that would take precedence, because, you know, as much as we don't want to let people down, we have to think of ourselves as
well. And there have been times when we have taken breaks, we have had to, you know, take a step back, you know, life happens, and we've both kind of looked at each other and said, listen, do we need to take a step back, do we need a few months to, you know,
look after ourselves?
And we have done that, and that's worked out really well,
and we've been really lucky that our publishers and the people we work with have been so supportive of that as well. And over the past year, when everything was kicking off, I didn't realise how much I value going to the countryside and being in wide open spaces. So I'm from the countryside, and I grew up, could not wait to get out of there, especially in my 20s. You know, I didn't even want to go home at the weekends. I wanted to socialise in Dublin. I wanted to live this city life. And as I got older, I realised that it's so nice to still be able to go down home like a good Aisling at the odd weekend and enjoy the open space. And I think during the pandemic time, especially, if I didn't get out to Phoenix Park, lucky enough I live near there, if I didn't get out to Phoenix Park once a day, I would absolutely crack up. And it helped me so much. I also got into sourdough baking, which gave me something to focus on. I created a sourdough starter from the very start. And I think just being able to switch off from something and just nurture your starter, make your bread, and then, I don't know, it allows the creative part of your brain to kind of relax a little while, and then you can go back to it later on and you just feel a bit more replenished, and you can, like, your well is full again and you can get the creative juices to flow.
Definitely one of my big issues is procrastination, and I have worked quite hard kind of using things like mindfulness, even like talking to a therapist about how to overcome kind of serious procrastination. Like, it's a real problem for a lot of people, I think, and it can become quite crippling. So I've kind of taught myself how to use, like, I think when you think of mindfulness, I used to think of, you know, it's about relaxing, it's about not thinking about anything, it's about lying, you know, with candles and maybe a nice cushion. And that's not what it's about at all. It's about thinking about what is going through your mind, you know, kind of making yourself okay with those thoughts, putting them to the side if they're not helpful, and getting on with your day. And I think that can really help with procrastination. I know that's helped me personally.
You've hit the 40-minute mark. Doing well.
Ashling's approach to fitness would be a bit like my own in that, why would you buy a gym membership when the pavements could be your gym? Pounding the pavements is Ashling's favourite way to stay fit.
She has always been a get your steps in girl. She was probably invented something like a Fitbit in her head before they ever even existed. She was like, wouldn't it be great now if you had something that would count the steps?
And Fit Flops.
Yeah,
all those little shoes that are designed to make you even fitter, Ashling would be all over those.
In one of the books, Ashling has an experience where she goes to a Pilates class and it's not really what she expected. That was based on a personal experience of mine where I said I'd go to a Pilates class. I had done yoga before. I was like, okay,
similar.
I can manage that. Pilates sounds kind of easier than yoga. It sounds kind of like more like lying around. Maybe there's some whale song playing, maybe some linen curtains. Genuinely, this is what I thought Pilates was. Well, when I got there and it started, it is like...
It's violent.
It is violent. I genuinely could not walk for 2 or 3 days afterwards. I was sweating. I was groaning. I couldn't believe. I was like, are you sure this is a Pilates class? Are you sure I haven't wandered into some kind of MMA nightmare instead?
Fighting with yourself on
the
mat.
So the Ashling in me was kind of disappointed that day that I had missed... I misunderstood so badly what Pilates was.
It's your own fault for deviating away from the footpath.
Do you know what? I felt great after it. And maybe I'll go back someday.
3 days later, when the DOMS are gone.
Yeah.
I think over the series of books, we've mentioned several times that Ashling has done the mini marathon a lot. She has the t-shirts to prove it.
I think when we first came up with Ashling, being a mini marathon fan was one of the cornerstones of her personality.
The Ashling Olympics.
We call it the Ashling Olympics. I've done the mini marathon several times. We've done it once together.
Mm-hmm.
I never run the whole thing. Actually, one of Ashling's goals would be to run the whole thing. You know, she's good for maybe a kilometre or two and then she needs to take a rest, like all good Ashlings.
It's one of my goals as well. And we were just reminiscing fondly on it earlier when we were preparing. And we were talking about our favourite bits of doing the mini marathon. Obviously, it's such a lovely social occasion. You know, Ashling would certainly get all her friends together to do it. But Eimear, you mentioned a bit about the firemen.
I don't know if this happens every year, but I've definitely seen it a few times, about at the halfway point, especially if it's a hot day. I feel like it is always good weather.
It's always
on the
a
day of the mini marathon.
Yeah.
Some Dublin firemen come out with hoses and just, you know, cool everyone down.
A little spritz.
Just a little spritz, just to keep you going, maybe at the 5K mark. It's delicious.
Yeah, you might fix your makeup just before you get there.
But in terms of Ashling doing the mini marathon, you know, I am an Ashling. Sarah, you're
absolutely
an Ashling as well. Like, I definitely still have some of my medals. Everyone who competes gets a medal. I definitely probably still have some of the goodie bags and they have the year on them and they're such great keepsakes and Ashling would definitely keep things like that.
Those little drawstring bags are so handy to have. She has so many of them, reusing them all the time. Ashling was sustainable before anybody else was.
She really was.
She keeps reusing those bits. Thank you. I think Aisling would have set up a WhatsApp group with her friends.
Definitely.
And they would be texting each other, you know, words of encouragement and support. You know, who's doing their steps today? Recording the steps, very important. Doing a bit of training. I know she's only going to walk it.
Yeah.
But you have to be reasonably fit to do
it. I think Aisling would probably start, if she's not already doing a bit of running or doing her 5K or whatever, would probably maybe get an app and, you know, get a bit of help with that. And, you know, I want to run a bit of it. I mean, some people obviously run the whole thing, but for it to be accessible to everyone, I think the walking aspect of it and the community aspect is really, really important. Obviously, it's an important 10K for a lot of people and they want to do personal bests and they want to, you know, reach that goal. But I just think the whole, like, anyone can do it. And definitely I felt that, like, varying levels of fitness years I've done it.
The year I did it, I was actually really worried that I wouldn't, because I didn't have any real concept about how long 10K was.
Yeah.
But it's very accessible. It's easy for everyone to do it. And it's so motivating to be in a big gang.
Yeah.
Everyone doing it together, which is, it's just really enjoyable. And I think any good Aisling would make a day of it.
Definitely.
You know, you'd book a table for lunch afterwards.
Yeah, you'd get your picture where a few people have to, you know, so you know when a group of women take a picture, at least four of them
stooping,
have to kind of crunch down for no reason whatsoever. A lot of those pictures taken on mini marathon day.
Yeah.
I know definitely, having done the VHI Women's Mini Marathon a few times myself, going for lunch or some kind of gathering afterwards is always something that can, I don't know, just bring the group together and say, yes, we did it.
Yeah, there's definitely an air of celebration in town that day, and it can actually be quite an emotional day as well, so I think you need to decompress a little bit. Yeah, sit down, have a nice lunch. I think when you get home, you need to do some kind of foot bath.
Yes, definitely.
Because the feet will be in bits. You might have a blister or two, or just maybe like a full bath, put on some music, some candles.
Aisling has definitely bought her mother at least three of those foot spa things. You know, they always come out at Christmas. So I think definitely if she has access to one of those, she might get it out and stick the feet in.
She'd dig it out for sure.
During the pandemic was the first time that I decided to really make a go of kind of one of those couch to 5K apps. You know, I had done a lot of walking before, I'd done a little bit of running, but I really wanted to kind of make a go. And I think this year for the VHI Virtual Women's Mini Marathon, doing something like that is probably going to be really important, because it's kind of a solo thing doing those couch to 5K apps or whatever. And this year doing the mini marathon isn't going to be the same experience that we've already talked about. It's not going to be the thousands of people on the street. Obviously, we're really looking forward to getting back to that. But this year it's going to be more of a virtual thing, more of people kind of connecting and saying, you know, I'm doing this, are you doing this, when are you doing yours, will we do them at the same time, or will two of us meet up together and try and do it. And I think the fact that a lot of people took up running and took up some kind of form of fitness during the pandemic is going to really help towards people taking part. in terms of kind of the whole arc of Aisling's story, we've always had a very vague idea of where she will end up. It's never been, you know, very concrete. We've never known exactly what's going to happen, but we've always had kind of an end game in mind. But saying that, we also have thrown ourselves into, I mean, we've just finished our fourth book, and we've thrown ourselves into all of those fourth books kind of blindly, kind of going, this is vaguely where we want to go.
And because there are two people writing it, like with the importance of being Aisling, that was our second book, you know, I would start just creating a little subplot, you know, something that we'd vaguely discussed, and then that can grow legs as well and then become something integral that we're going to bring back in a future book. So you can plan to a certain extent, but I think other authors say this as well. Once your characters get on the page and you start writing, they do mad stuff.
Yeah.
You can't predict what they're going to do sometimes.
And before I was writing books, I would have thought that was kind of a cliche, like, oh, that, you know, that just sounds like something a writer says, but it is actually true. And you start giving the character more characteristics and you're like, oh, that person would never do that. And I remember in book two particularly, there's a lot of the plot is sausage based.
So the sausage farce.
Yeah, as we started calling it the sausage farce, we were like, we will never get away with this sausage storyline. But people loved it.
Oh, we're still writing about sausages in book four,
yeah.
Somehow.
We have managed to turn sausages into like a really important kind
it's
of
a theme.
Backbone of the Aisling universe. And we had a similar farce in book three. There's an NDA scenario and we were like, nobody's ever going to buy this. We're never going to get away with this. But you forget, you're writing fiction. You're writing a world that people are immersed in.
And as I say to Emer sometimes when we're talking about some more far-fetched escapades, you know, people believe in science fiction. You know, they're sending people to different planets and stuff. We can surely get away with this.
We can get away with the sausage farce. We do end up doing this a lot where I'll say my bit is rubbish but I know Sarah's bit is going to be good and that'll elevate it, and she says the same thing, and kind of when it comes together, the kind of chemistry of the two things does, I mean, it makes a thing that people seem to enjoy. But when you're in the thick of it, and especially I remember book two, like they call it a difficult second album for a reason, because, you know, once you've had that success and then there's such expectation, and we just really didn't want to let people down. We didn't want to see those reviews that was like, oh, they were a one trick pony, you know, that was a flash in the pan. And I think this happens a lot with creators. I think maybe women in particular tend to feel a little bit of that imposter syndrome, a little bit of, I don't deserve to be here, I don't deserve this success. And it has taken probably up until quite recently for me, I can't speak for Sarah, to go, maybe that's not the case here. Maybe we have created something that people like and people enjoy, and it's okay to acknowledge that. One of the more unbelievable moments in our Aisling journey was the day we found out we got a UK book deal. So that's, I mean, Aisling is such kind of an Irish thing. It's very, you know, it's about an Irish girl, it's about an Irish town.
And it's so specific. I mean, our Aisling is from a very small place in the countryside, and we didn't hold back when we were talking about in colloquialisms and just the way we speak. So we didn't in a million years think that anybody outside of Ireland would get it. And then lo, there was an auction situation with UK publishers.
Yeah,
which was
after we got our agent. So one of the agent's jobs is to then go and kind of sell you to publishers, you know, outside of Ireland. And she came back to us and said, well, there's a number of publishers interested, so they're going to have a bidding war on, you know, who's going to get the contract. We could not believe it. And I think that was the day that Sarah particularly kind of decided, okay, I'm going to be able to give up, you know, my other work that I'm doing. I was kind of freelancing at the time doing other bits of writing, but Sarah was still kind of going to an office and working a good bit, and she said, okay, this is going to give me the freedom to make this my full-time job. Like, I can remember that day so clearly. I remember where we were
in a car park, we screamed.
Yeah.
But then when the book came out in the UK, we had to make some changes to it.
Yeah,
didn't we, Emer?
Yeah.
Because there are some things, I mean, they got the overall vibe of the book, and I think that what their editors were saying was that, you know, Aisling is a universal character, So to us, she's very kind of local to us. But her journey and her experience is a universal experience. But there were things that we had written into the book that the people in England didn't get, and people in the UK. And we had Cúpla Focal that we had to kind of take out. We had mentioned...
We got such funny lists of things, kind of queries. So it would be like, what's a purple snack? And I mean, purple snack is one of Aisling's most favourite treats, but they don't, you know,
don't
a purple snack doesn't really mean anything to people in the UK. O'Neill's Traxy Bottoms, which in the books we just refer to as O'Neill's. Everyone knows what your O'Neill's are.
Not them. They don't know. They don't know what meanies are. Yeah. God love them.
Didn't know what meanies were. Francis didn't know who Francis Brennan was. Didn't know who Dermot Bannon was.
Didn't
God
know
forbid.
What a county jersey is.
Yeah.
Because
so
they don't have that.
And little things like, what's an ESB poll? Like, to us, that's just like, it's an ESB poll. What else could it be? But to them, they were like, what could that possibly mean? So it was really interesting process to go through and have to change. Some of them we kind of fought back on. We didn't change everything because we were like, we don't want to take every, you know, the essence away. But there were some things that the word in Irish, plumas, and I was like, what does this mean? It's actually quite hard to define.
There is no English translation of plumas.
But I think we did have to come up with something. Yeah. But we had to take out Francis Brennan.
I think we changed him to Philip Schofield.
We changed him to Philip
Schofield. Kind of a housewife favourite.
We were trying to think of a UK equivalent.
And then, so because we struggled with that a little bit, or we had a bit of crack when we were doing that, you can imagine our surprise when we got book deals for places like
Germany,
South Korea,
Czech Republic.
It took on legs that we never ever
so
expected.
So I have at home something I genuinely never thought I would have, is one of those shelves where it has every kind of version of Aisling that has been put out into the world. I have a shelf with every version in a row, and there's the Czech one and the German one and the English one.
And there's a book award at each end of it.
Book ended by book award.
Aisling's, or I was going to call you Aisling, Emer's ego shelf. So in Once, Twice, Three Times at Aisling, Aisling moves from her 20s into her 30s, and she's feeling a lot of these pressures because some of her friends are getting engaged, some of them are having babies, and she feels a little bit left behind. But she has to kind of change her outlook. And I know when I was turning 30, it was such a tumultuous time because I was very reluctant to let go of my young, carefree self, but at the same time, I was in a very serious relationship. And I think, you know, an example of that juxtaposition is I ended up having a baby when I was 30, but I also spent my 30th birthday in Disney World. So it's a strange time.
And it's so funny when you, like, I think back to when I turned 30 and I felt like I was so old and that I couldn't believe I'd reached this ancient milestone. And I look back on that now and I'm like, I was such a baby. And I look back on Aisling now, like I'm, you know, a few years older than Aisling is, you know, in the Aisling universe now, she's 31 in the fourth book. And to some people that seems like, oh, that's ancient. You have to have these things achieved by then. I have to, you know, be in a relationship. I have to have started a family if I want one. And I look back on that and I go, that's so ridiculous. And the world has changed so much. And I think the world has changed, is changing for women a lot, whereby some of those pressures are being lifted or being extended. And there isn't that kind of on the shelf feeling. And I think giving that feeling to Aisling has been important to us because she started off the series very much like, I have to, you know, X, Y, and Z. I have to have the house, the husband, the baby, you know, the life. And where she is now in her fourth book, she doesn't have any of those things. And that's fine.
And we have been talking amongst ourselves about the benefits of getting older recently. We've been chatting about it a lot and just about how I care so much less about what people think of me in regards of, like, you know, how I dress, how my hair is, things I would have been anxious or shy about doing when I was in my 20s or 30s, like, you know, waiting outside a restaurant to meet somebody. You know, I want to just be invisible and disappear. And now I just don't care. I care so much less.
It's actually one, if any, you're going to sound like an ancient old crone now, but like if any younger person is asked me, like if I've ever asked for advice, I always say that I promise you the older you get, the less you care about what people think about you. I mean, maybe it's not strictly true in a professional sense, so we're always going to worry what people think about our books, but just as a whole, I think you definitely move away from that worry and move more into, I just want to enjoy my life, I just want to live my life, and you know,
it's so freeing.
Yes, very freeing.
60 minutes done. You're on the home stretch.
In terms of social media and Aisling, I feel like we've had quite a positive experience. I think some people do end up having negative experiences, but that hasn't been our kind of take on it. We have so many people who get in touch, and they have done since the first book. And for various reasons.
Yeah, we're so accessible on social media. Like, Emer and I are both on Twitter and Instagram, and we get messages from people all the time. I remember when the first book came out, and there's an abortion storyline in the first book, not to give away too many spoilers. But we got a message from somebody who said that she really wanted, you know, in with the referendum coming up, she really wanted to bring up the topic with older women in her family, and she felt like she couldn't. And our book was so available at that stage. Like, our book was a special buy in Lidl around that time, and she just said that everyone had read it, and it just made it so easy to bring up that topic, and like, that was so gratifying for us to hear. And then we get messages from people who are all over the world as well, who just say that they miss home, and reading the Aisling books is just like having a little slice of home wherever they are.
And we'll get messages from people who'll specify bits of the book that I forget exist, and they're like, I love the bit when this happens, I love when Magella does this, and I'm like, oh my god, I forgot that ever happened. In the first book in particular, there is a storyline about a parent dying, and we got lots of messages when the book first came out saying, oh, I really relate to that experience, and I feel like you were in the room with me when it happened, and that kind of thing. So that was kind of really gratifying, that it, you know, kind of gave some comfort or solace to people. But we still to this day get so many messages from people, and people are so excited about the fourth book coming out. We've, for the past year, we've been getting, when is Aisling 4? When is the book? When is the book coming out?
So for me, one of my proudest moments of achievement after the books came out was winning an Irish Book Award. In fact, we were nominated for an Irish Book Award for our first book. We didn't win, unfortunately, but we won for The Importance of Being Aisling and Once, Twice, Three Times an Aisling, which was really, really cool.
And we genuinely didn't think we were going to win the second time for the third book. We were so convinced that we just hadn't even prepared to leave the table at the Book Awards. We were kind of, you know, our category came up and we kind of leaned back and said, this is fine. I probably had no shoes on, you know, we don't really need to go up on stage. And the next thing, they announced that we were the winners, and it was such a nice experience to go up with Sarah, for the two of us to be able to go up together and do it together. It's just really, really nice. And like, we've got to travel so much together. We've got to sit in front of audiences of people who are laughing and nodding along with us, or who, you know, have obviously been touched by something we've written. And that, like, I remember saying to a friend, you know, having kind of an existential conversation and being like, you know, what do we really do with this time we have on earth? And she was like, well, you bring so much joy to people in the books that you write. And like, that's a small thing that somebody said, but it has really stuck with me. And that's kind of a big moment of pride for me, definitely.
My advice for anyone who's looking to get into journalism is find out what you want to write about. So it might feel like, oh, I should write about politics, or I should write about, I don't know, X, Y, and Z. But if you want to do something for a career, you want to be enjoying it every day. So if you want to write about fashion, or if you want to write about sport, find the editor who is editing the section that you most enjoy reading and send them an email. It doesn't have to be a long email, but just maybe put together a pitch, what you'd like to write about, and maybe 200 words. It doesn't have to be very long, about what your niche might be, or how you can bring your own specific angle or voice to something.
And then writing kind of beyond journalism, if someone was interested in fiction or writing novels or short stories, there are so many outlets for that, particularly in Ireland. There are so many kind of magazines and volumes that want to take your short stories. They want you to practice, they want you to put them in. I'm thinking of ones like Banshee, and there's Stinging Fly. There are so many different ones. And I mean, writing is all about practice. That's what Sarah and I have found. I mean, when we wrote our first book, we had no practice in writing books. And even when we look back on that first book now, we can see how far we've come. People say they love the book, we're a bit like, oh, it feels to us a little bit amateurish. Like, we can see just how far along we've come. We've just finished our fourth book, and you know, it's a very different process. It's all about practice. As Sarah said, it's about writing what you want to read about. And I remember reading something quite recently. It was like, if you're not sure about what you want to write about, write about anything you have a question about. So if you're like, I want to know what I think about X, Y, or Z, and the best thing to do is then interrogate yourself and say, okay, what do I think about this, if that makes sense. I find that really helpful when you're trying to think about things to write. Sometimes you can be staring at a blank page and just be going, where do I start? So just answer a question that you have in your head.
And you don't have to have a publishing deal to be a writer. All you have to do is sit down and write. And you don't necessarily, one day, you know, you're not going to get this divine inspiration like a bolt of lightning to the head. You know, to just sit down and just start typing and see where it goes.
The writing community in Ireland, we have found since we kind of crashed into it, is really, really supportive. Like, surprisingly so. Not that I ever thought it wasn't supportive, but like from the very second Sarah and I's first book came out, we were just inundated with just kindness and support and messages from people who previously we were like, they're celebrities. Like, we obviously will never meet these people.
It's so welcoming. And I think Twitter has been really invaluable for us in that sense. It allows you to connect with other writers. People are so generous with their time and their book reviews. And it's only when you have a book coming out, you realize, oh my God, it's so important to get these words from people. And people have been just so great to us. It's just been an unbelievable experience.
In terms of what's coming next for Aisling, Sarah and I have just finished our fourth book. We took a year off in 2020, which kind of worked out well because the pandemic hit, and we didn't take the year off because of the pandemic. We just happened to have taken a year off, and it actually worked out really well.
It was great timing on our part.
It was really good timing. So this is our first book out since 2019. So we're really excited about it. We have taken Aisling really out of her comfort zone. We've taken her out of Ireland in this book. So she is moving to, can we say where she's moving to?
Can we? I think, yeah, we can. Let's do it.
So Aisling moves to New York in this book, and Sarah and I have kind of, we had one holiday in New York together a few years ago. We've both been to New York, you know, separately. It's a place where a lot of Irish people go. It's a place we've always sent Aisling. You know, she's always talked about going to New York, and you know, she goes to the M&M store in Times Square, and she, you know, gets her Tommy Hilfiger bits, and she, you know, it's just a very Aisling experience. So we kind of wanted to really send her out of her comfort zone and send her to New York, where she interacts with a lot of people who aren't Irish, where she interacts with a lot of people who are Irish, and it's just how she kind of makes her way there. Like, she's very much on her own, more or less. So we're really excited for people to read. Obviously we're nervous.
Yeah, having taken the year off in 2020, it was so nice to come back to our book writing in a much kind of more refreshed way. And we just feel like, I don't know, I feel like this might be our best one yet.
Sarah, big talk.
I know, big words. I don't know, I just feel like if you like the first, second and third books, yeah, you're really going to like the fourth, yeah, book. And we have, you know, a lot of our favourite characters from BGB and beyond, and then we have a whole host of new people. I can say that you know, we get a lot of messages about Mandy Blumenthal, who was the wedding planner in book four. She's a New Yorker.
Book three, sorry. Yeah.
And she makes a triumphant comeback in book four, and we see more of her, and I think people will be really pleased about that.
Yeah. And then book five, which we'll maybe start working on before the end of this year.
We should probably get on that soon.
Yeah, anyway. That's going to be our final Aisling book. We have agreed to do five books. We didn't want to kind of drag it out too long. Didn't want to, you know, flog a dead horse or be accused of flogging a dead horse. So we've kind of decided what's going to happen ultimately to Aisling.
We sat down at a kitchen table and we kind of did an overall arc of where Aisling is going to be at the end of the second book, where we're happy for her to be, and we think that people will be happy for her to be. Yeah. And we've actually spent the last couple of books working towards this kind of vague goal. Now, as regards everything else that's going to happen in the background, we're not too sure.
No, we'll throw everything at it and see what happens. But, and I mean, we've been working on writing Aisling for the screen, which is really exciting.
That's a whole other ball game.
That's a whole other thing we've had to kind of learn and perfect and try.
And it's been challenging.
Very challenging.
But I'm actually quite emotional thinking about the fifth and final Aisling book.
Yeah, I think it's going to be, I can't imagine when it comes out, and I can't imagine what it's going to be like to not have one come out after that, you know, and to say goodbye to her and kind of wrap up her. I mean, people always say, oh, you'll come back and write another one, or you'll, you know, you'll bring her back in 10 years. Never say never. But it will be kind of sad to say goodbye to her. And who knows what's going to happen after that. Sarah and I would love to keep working together. We'd love to work on our own projects. We can't believe we've gotten here to where we started in 2016, 2017. So God only knows where we're going to be in another 5 or 6 years. Like, it's kind of exciting.
Yeah, and we're very grateful for Ashing, really, for being our vehicle to get us here.
Yeah. So as people are working towards their VHI Virtual Women's Mini Marathon, I have a little bit of advice. I mean, it's not that special when it comes to kind of running advice, but when I was doing Couch to 5K and trying to get into it a bit last year, one of the apps that I had used told me to pick a mantra for running, and just when things were feeling really tough or things were feeling hard, just repeat it to yourself. And my mantra was, my body can do this, my body will do this. And I found it really, really helpful, because I think when you're running and when you're struggling, the thing is to tell yourself that your body is built to do this, you know, and to see the movement and the exercise as joy rather than a punishment. And I think as you're, you know, working towards doing your VHI Women's Mini Marathon, that it's important to keep that in mind. So we just want to wish everyone really the best of luck.
Yes, and well done. You've come this far. You can do it.
You can do
complete
it.
The VHI Virtual Women's Mini Marathon.
If Sarah and I can do it, anyone can do it.
Well done. You've reached the end of your 75 minutes and the end of this podcast series. If you've enjoyed it, please rate, subscribe and share with friends so it can help others prepare and train for the VHI Women's Mini Marathon or any 10K route after that. You can register for this year's event at vhiwomensminimarathon.ie. Good luck on the rest of your journey.